Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. That is our it's our goal that here on Faith Radio and on the program especially, that we'll find ways that we can look at what God's Word has to say and apply it to everyday life. And we talk about some of the important issues of the day and big concerns and say, you know, what does God's Word have to say about it? How do we look at the world through a biblical worldview lens? We're going to talk a bit about worldview today because it certainly has affected a significant area in our culture and society, as we're going to focus a bit on environment. And the book we're going to reference was written by our guest today called Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. And Ryan had promised our guest today that we'd mention at least eastern Montana at least once.
Yes, it's a beautiful, grand place.
It is, yes. So, I mean, we'd... If well, Adam, I'm not sure if that comes in the garden or wilderness. We'll find out. Let me introduce my guest. Happy to have Dr. E. Calvin Beisner back with us today. He's the founder, national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. The Cornwall Alliance is a network of theologians, pastors, and other ministry leaders, scientists, economists, and other scholars and policy experts committed to applying biblical principles to the twin challenges of economic development for the very poor around the world and wise earth stewardship. And Cal has a long list of degrees and studies in economic ethics, and there's a Scottish history.
Yes.
And he's a former editor of Discipleship Journal, been a newspaper editor, reporter, publisher, radio commentator, written, I think it was like 10 or 12 books, a number of books anyway. He also has served as an associate professor of history, theology, historical theology, and social ethics at Knox Theological Seminary in Fort Lauderdale. We're happy to have Cal Beisner back with us on Connecting Faith. And welcome, Cal. We're grateful that you can carve out a little time for us today.
Well, Neil, Ryan, thank you very much for having me on the show. That was kind of a big buildup. I don't know if I can live up to all that.
Yes, well, so... You know, but Montana's a big place, so we kind of we had to make it big.
Amen.
So now
and
Ryan,
it's a beautiful place.
It is, and Ryan's fine now, so we can move on. But I did want to. We should say maybe just before we start, a word about the Cornwall Alliance. As we just mentioned, it is a network. It's something that you've been passionate about over the years, and it's hopefully a building, a growing, and a significant organization.
Well, we have, in our network, we have about 60 scholars, roughly evenly divided among the theologian, philosopher, ethicist types, and the scientists, natural scientists, whether they're physical sciences, biological sciences, et cetera, and then also economists. Some focus on general economics, others on the economics of development, how countries go from poor to wealthy, and others on environmental economics. And so we try to bring those three threads, those three different general disciplines of theology and science and economics together to provide an interdisciplinary, mature way of answering different challenges facing our world today, and examining different issues, and particularly assessing the arguments pro and con. Too many times various different people's positions will be taken up really from a fairly narrow argumentative background, whereas we need to have something that's a whole lot broader, something that takes in the Word of God, as well as what we observe in the natural world around us and our understanding of human nature. And really, that's what those three disciplines do: theology and science and economics.
Cal, we just chatted just a moment before the broadcast, and you gave out a number which just sort of is amazing to me. But because I know in the book Where Garden Meets Wilderness, it was published several years ago, so the the numbers have been updated. But then it was like, you know, some 500 or so organizations mm-hmm. that are focused on environmental concerns. But that number is just magnified. So, I mean, talk about
the
number and what the implications of what that means.
Yeah. Well, there are over 13,000 nonprofit organizations in the United States that are registered with the IRS as specifically environmental in their focus, in their work. And their annual revenues now exceed $21 billion. So this is a major issue, which, by the way, shouldn't be terribly surprising because of the very meaning of the word environment itself. The word environment comes from a French word meaning to turn around, and it literally means surroundings. And, you know, Neil, I have been trying for a long time to try to figure out anything that isn't part of our surroundings. Not the sun, not Alpha Centauri, and not the hair on the back of your head. Everything is part of our surroundings. So really, environment just simply means everything. And that means that environmentalism translates into everythingism. And I'll even go one step farther there, too. We have another term for that in the English language. It's called totalitarianism. And that's why environmentalism has a sort of a natural tendency toward wanting to put government in charge of every aspect of our lives. It wants a control over everything around us.
Well, and maybe we just need to talk then a bit about the worldview. I mean, I want to give you a chance to sort of talk about some of the premises of the modern environmental movement, but let's expand that a bit because, you know, at the Cornwall Alliance and what you've been speaking on for years is, you know, where is the biblical Christian perspective to add to this discussion about our surroundings? But talk worldview, how that has really shaped where this debate has gone today.
Well, an awful lot of the environmental movement is fundamentally anti-Christian in its worldview. And there are basically two families of worldview in the environmental movement. One of them is atheistic secular. That's what dominated thinking in the West from the Enlightenment until just very, very recently, say the 1980s and 90s. The other tends to be more Eastern mystical, and thus it tends to embrace pantheism, the notion that God is everything, God is the universe, or panentheism, God is to the universe as the soul is to the body, or animism or spiritism. There are lots of little gods, little spirits that inhabit rocks and trees and rivers and animals and people and things like that, and these tend to be capricious. At any rate, we don't find a biblical Christian worldview very widespread among environmentalists. Doesn't mean that there are no Christian environmentalists, but they don't tend to be terribly influential in the movement. The biblical Christian worldview, of course, is not atheistic, and it's not pantheistic or panentheistic or animistic. It is theistic, and it's specifically Trinitarian theistic. That is, there is a tripersonal God, one God, who is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable, in his wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth, who created the universe out of nothing. It is not himself. It's not an extension of him. It's not an emanation out from him or anything like that. He created the universe out of nothing. And he made human beings in his own image so that while we are creatures, we're different from all the other creatures. And that's why he gives to us dominion over the earth. He tells us in Genesis 1:28, he blesses us and he says to us, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and everything that moves on the face of the earth. So that's kind of the basic biblical worldview that we should bring to our understanding of creation stewardship. And it differs very significantly from the other worldviews.
Is it the word dominion that seems to be the catch that people maybe react to so often?
Yeah, I think they do, and it's very tempting. I think it's a temptation we need very much to resist, but it's very tempting for evangelical Christians to say, let's get along, let's try to defuse the opposition by not using that term. But that's the term that God used. That's the biblical term, and I think we need to learn to think in biblical terminology. We need to be brave enough to defend that biblical terminology. When we give it up, what we're doing is we're allowing our thoughts to be taken captive by the word, by the world. But what Scripture teaches us is that we are supposed to conduct spiritual warfare in which the weapons of our warfare are not carnal but are spiritual, to the tearing down of strongholds and the refutation of every argument that sets itself up against God, to the end that we take captive every thought to the obedience of Christ. That's all taking from 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And so we need to be ready to defend this term, and then we need to be ready to define it, too. And the way we define it in the Cornwall Alliance is this: godly earth stewardship, or biblical dominion, means men and women created in the image of God laboring together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and to the benefit of our neighbors. Now, who in the world could possibly be against that? That's what we mean by dominion, not exploitation, not abuse. We don't use this term to justify, you know, wasting things or poisoning things. We mean we want to promote the beauty, the safety, and the fruitfulness of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our fellow men.
We'll talk more about that. It's the mission of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, that we understand what it means to not only defend but define the dominion, and that we do it all for God's glory. We're talking with E. Calvin Beisner. Dr. Beisner is the founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance, and he's a graduate University of Southern California. He's a specialization in economic ethics. He's also has a degree in Scottish history from the University of St. Andrews in St. Andrews, Scotland. He has written a number of books. The one we're referencing today is called Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. In a moment, we'll talk a little bit about how the modern environmental movement looks at things like population and resources and land use. And we'll talk about resisting the green dragon coming up in a moment.
Ten years ago, when I was recovering from scoliosis back surgery, I was in such pain, just emotionally and spiritually and physically, that I didn't think I'd ever recover. I felt out of control, and I just hated that. Hey, this is Debbie Griffith with Everyday Matters. I simply wanted Jesus to remove all my pain. Make it go away, I cried to him. Well, thankfully, my Aunt Ginger encouraged me to take my trial as a class, and this changed everything, because instead of praying for God to remove me from my class of pain and circumstances, I asked him to bless and teach me the lessons I needed to learn. And during this time, I received a postcard from Aunt Ginger which said, "How's class going? I know you're being a good student." Well, not always, but how true Hebrews 12:11 was and is, no training is enjoyable while it's happening. It's painful, but afterward, there will be a harvest of right living and peace for those who are trained in this way every day. For more encouragement, visit DebbieGriffith.com.
To Connecting Faith, and 17 past the hour, talking today with Dr. Cal Beisner. Cal is author and speaker on the application of biblical worldview to economics, government, and environmental policies. Published a number of books and lots of articles, and has been associate professor of historical theology and social ethics at Knox Theological Seminary, and teaches apologetics, comparative religions, ethics, a number of things. And we are glad to have him with us today. We're talking about a book that he wrote several years ago called Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. And we're talking environment today. And by the way, you're welcome to join the discussion. You have a question or a comment. Maybe you have some experiences in trying to carry on some debates or dialogue about issues of environment, whether it's climate change or whatever it might be. It's 877-933-2484. That's our phone number, 877 833-244-2484. Or if it's more convenient, you can drop us a note via email by going to our website, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's a link right there, myfaithradio.com. Cal, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we talked a little bit about how the worldview of modern sort of environmental movement has shaped where, you know, how views are lived out or focused on. But I want to talk a little bit about maybe some of the premises as it relates to, for example, resources. I would assume that maybe the modern movements say, well, resources are scarce, and so we sort of have the scarcity mentality.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it is true. Resources are scarce. but that is an economic term. And what it really means is simply that everybody can't have all that he would want of a given resource at zero cost. That's all that it means. It means that there's going to be a cost to acquiring any resource, a cost in time, a cost in labor, a cost perhaps in money, a cost in choosing to use your time to do this instead of to do that. That's what scarcity means. And the interesting thing is that if you look at material resources, that is, whether they're mineral or vegetable or animal, right? All the things that we take out of the earth, all material resources, the long-term price trend of those after adjusting for inflation is downward. And especially by comparison with the cost of human labor, it's downward even faster. What that means, since price is a measure of scarcity, as price falls, you know that scarcity is falling. That is, the things that we take out of the earth, mineral, animal, vegetable, those things are getting less scarce over time, not more scarce, and that's exactly the opposite of what the environmental movement claims. And you have to wonder, well, if the data are there, and they are, why does the environmental movement think this way? It's because of its presuppositions about human beings. Human beings, biblically we're told that we're made in God's image and God is creative and productive. I mean, that's the very first thing you learn about him in Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But the environmental movement doesn't see us that way. It sees us basically as just other animals, as consumers and polluters rather than as producers and stewards. And so it sees us as using up resources, not creating resources. It sees us as poisoning the planet while we're at it, rather than actually improving the planet. But God has given us the mandate in Genesis 1:28 to subdue and have dominion over the earth for the purpose of enhancing its fruitfulness, that is, enhancing its resources, and making it a safer place, not making it a more polluted place. And because we're made in God's image, even despite the fall into sin, we can do that, and we have been doing that, which is why, particularly since the great blossoming of the Christian message across the world from the Reformation period forward, and with the Industrial Revolution that spurred, we have seen not only human population but also human life expectancy rise dramatically around the world. Instead of people having a life expectancy at birth of around 27 to 28 years, which is what it was up until the late 1700s, now in the developed world it's about 80 years. In most of the rest of the world, tends to run about 65 years. That's quite amazing. But it's because we're made in God's image that we're able to make these changes.
So, as opposed to looking at population as a bane and a risk,
yes.
I mean, we can see God is able to provide, I guess, and keep us moving forward, right?
Yeah, a lot of environmentalists will talk about what they call the carrying capacity of the earth, and they'll say we have exceeded Earth's carrying capacity. Well, as a matter of fact, the Earth's carrying capacity, if we're just talking about how many people will the Earth support, if people just simply go out and gather their food as they find it in the earth, not, no agriculture, no farming, no industry, anything like that. How many people would the earth support? Well, even in the very best of habitats, hunting and gathering can only support about 1 to 2 people per square mile. Earth's current population is over 300 people per square mile. That's population density. That's way beyond Earth's carrying capacity, and that ought to tell us something. It isn't Earth that carries us. It is God who carries us through the intelligence that he's given us to transform the Earth, to make it do things that it wouldn't do apart from our transforming activity. So the real carrying capacity is people, and people are able to make more resources than we consume by transforming raw materials into real resources.
Which, I guess, gets to the area of land use, then, sort of another premise we should talk about. I mean, we always talk about sort of wise use versus no use, right? But that,
yes.
Those are a couple of the key distinctives, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. And an awful lot of the environmental movement really thinks that the Earth is best untouched by human hands, that there is something sacred, something sacrosanct about wild nature. Now, first of all, there is no part of the Earth, and there hasn't been for hundreds and hundreds of years, that has not been touched by and transformed by human hands. So the notion that we're going to have wild nature, pristine nature, is long, long past being anachronistic. But second, the Bible specifically says that we are supposed to subdue and have dominion over the earth, that we're not supposed to just leave it in the condition in which we find it. It's much like the parable of the talents. The master is going to be going away. He gives to each of his servants a talent, and he says, you know, use this until I return. He comes back later, and one of the servants has multiplied the one talent into 10 talents, and the master congratulates him and gives him even more authority. Another servant has multiplied it into 2 talents. He congratulates him, gives him more authority. Another servant has said, well, I knew you to be a hard master who reaps where he doesn't sow, so I just simply buried your talent in the ground. Here you go. It's back to you as you gave it to me. And the master condemns him, calls him you wicked and lazy servant. And then he points out, of course, that he wasn't a hard master who reaps where he doesn't sow, because after all, I gave you the talent. But if you really thought I was that way, why didn't you at least put the money in the bank where it would have returned interest? And then he takes that talent away from that servant, gives it to the one who multiplied to 10, and casts that servant away into outer darkness. Now, when we see the earth around us, we should see it as that talent entrusted to us by God. And our task is not just to preserve it as we find it, but to make it more fruitful, more beautiful, and more safe for other human beings and ourselves than it was when we first found it. That's a fundamental difference between a biblical understanding of godly dominion or earth stewardship and the typical environmental thinking.
I've just been reading in Isaiah, and I was reading in your book, you talk about, you know, prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, they have this vision of barren land versus, you know, yeah, God's blessing. And it's pretty stark in contrast about what God thinks is the blessing.
Yeah, and it really stems right from those first chapters of Genesis. In Genesis 1, we get the general story of creation as a whole. In Genesis 2, we get the story focused specifically on the creation of man, and particularly we're told where he is placed at the beginning. God puts Adam into the Garden of Eden to cultivate and guard it. That's Genesis 2:15. And if we compare Genesis 2:15 and 1:28, which is where God blesses them and says to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it, the picture we get is that man starts in the Garden of Eden, which, by the way, represents the place of intimate fellowship with God. He's to start there. He's to cultivate, which means to enhance even the fruitfulness of that perfect place, right? And he's to guard that garden against what? Well, against the encroachment of what is outside the garden, which is wilderness. But then in 1:28, he's told to multiply and fill the earth. So he's to spread out from the garden and to transform the rest of the earth into garden, turning wilderness into garden. And in the scriptures, we find almost invariably that the concept of wilderness is associated with the curse or the judgment of God on human sin. Wilderness is used to describe either places that have not yet been subdued by man or places that were once subdued but under the judgment of God have been returned to their natural wild state. Garden, on the other hand, represents the place of fellowship with God, and in fact we're told that, well, the earth begins in a garden, in the Garden of Eden, and it ends, at the end of the book of Revelation, in a garden city, the New Jerusalem, which is symbolically pictured as coming down out of heaven. This is the earth having been subdued and brought under dominion by godly human beings, which, by the way, tells us that the dominion mandate, or the cultural mandate, as many people call Genesis 1:28, has to be tied in our minds to the Great Commission of Matthew 28:19, where Jesus tells the disciples to go and make disciples of all nations. We're not going to do the dominion mandate right unless we are reconciled to God by Christ.
We'll jump in right there and come back, talk more with Cal Beisner just a moment here from the Cornwall Alliance, talking about where garden meets wilderness, talking about the environmental debate today. You're welcome to join us at 877-93-FAITH. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We've connected today with Dr. E. Calvin Beisner, who's the founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. He's an author and speaker on the application of biblical worldview to economics, government, and environmental policies. Published a number of books, lots of articles, as a professor, and has a radio outreach. And he's joining us today as we talk about some of what's going on in the environmental movement. The subtitle to one of his books is called Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Movement, the title Where Garden Meets Wilderness. By the way, you can find out more about his writings on the website cornwallalliance.org. I want to give you another website as well, because we want to talk about a DVD, a video lecture series that I put together called Resisting the Green Dragon. You can find that at resistingthegreendragon.com. But Cal, I'm interested just in light of that, in that resistance, you know, is there a way that we can go on the offensive, or are there some positive ways in which, constructive ways in which we can lead? Because it seems like we are almost always reactionary on this issue.
Yeah, I think there's some very constructive things that we can do to lead on this sort of thing. The first thing, of course, is simply that we need to have a sound biblical worldview ourselves and a sound understanding of what humanity is. The world around us has basically forgotten that men and women are made in the image of God. In fact, in many ways, it has forgotten God. I mean, I'm thinking back at the moment to Alexander Solzhenitsyn's brilliant speech, Men Have Forgotten God. That's why all this has happened back in the 1970s, looking at the debacle of the 20th century, and especially all that happened in the Soviet Union that was so destructive to so many people. And he said, you know, why did this happen? Well, it's because men have forgotten God. Well, also, men have forgotten that people are created in God's image. So we need to start there, and to have a much more wonderful, much more respectful understanding of what it means to be a human being. I mean, when the environmental movement says that we are the population bomb, people pollution, the population explosion, a cancer on the face of the earth, things like that, that's pretty derogatory. But to think that we are, as Psalm 8 puts it, not only made in the image of God, but crowned with glory and honor, made a little bit lower than God himself. This is tremendous, and it can give us a whole new way of thinking about our possibilities, our potentialities. And that also should remind us, though, that we had these great potentials, but we have hurt them in many ways because of sin, and that, of course, reminds us of the need that we have for reconciliation with God, and the only way that comes is by faith in Jesus Christ. So the first step, really, is for us to be preaching the gospel in order for people to be reconciled to God through Christ, so that instead of living as if they were just animals, they can live as the very image of God. And then, you know, we move on from there to some fairly concrete things. One thing that we can do is to take action to enhance the fruitfulness of the earth through modern agricultural techniques that allow us to grow far more food on far less land, which then allows us to use other land for other purposes, including for nature preserves, including for wildlife preserves, things of that sort. It also suggests that we ought to be taking steps to reduce the risk of harm from natural disasters. In a fallen world, these things happen. But if we have proper flood control systems, if we have well-built buildings that can withstand earthquakes or hurricanes, tornadoes, things like that, then we protect people. Perfect Storm Sandy hit the U.S. Northeast, yes, it caused billions of dollars of damage, but it only took about 100 lives total out of an enormous area. When a similar cyclone hit Burma, the deaths there were in the millions, and yet the difference came from the fact that we had learned here and we had built through our productive economy the capacity to protect people from that kind of thing. So those are things that we as Christians can promote. And then there's a lot more too, you know, that we go into in that video series that you mentioned, Resisting the Green Dragon.
Well, speaking of the Green Dragon, are there some aspects of the current, the Green Dragon that are most troublesome? And maybe, and then on the other side of that, maybe are there some areas where we've made important advances?
Yeah, I think. First, some troublesome things. One of the lectures in that series is by Charmaine Yost. She is the president of Americans United for Life, the oldest pro-life organization in the United States. And she lectures on the anti-human face, the pro-death agenda of the environmental movement. Much of the environmental movement, because it sees people as basically consumers and polluters rather than as producers and stewards, believes firmly that we have overpopulated the earth, that we need to reduce human population, so it favors population control through eugenics, through forced or highly incentivized sterilization, and through abortion. So environmental movement and the population control and pro-abortion movement run hand in hand around the world. That's one of the real problems in it. Another one is the twisting of our understanding of how the world works. Dr. Vishal Mangalwadi, who is an Indian Christian philosopher, speaks in that series on how the environmental movement flies from reason and substitutes mysticism for logos, for the image of God in man, our rational capacity. And this is what happens when you import either an Eastern mystical worldview or, frankly, a Western atheistic secular worldview. When people take God out of their worldview, Romans chapter 1 tells us that God gives them over to their desires. Professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. And that's what happens. The rational capacity begins to diminish. And we see that, for example, in an awful lot of the environmentalist claims of crisis. I've studied particularly in enormous depth the whole claim about we're causing dangerous global warming by the use of fossil fuels and emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. An awful lot of what goes on there, surprisingly enough, is not good science at all. It's not rational. It is instead what people have come to refer to as post-normal science, which is essentially postmodern deconstructionism, which says language doesn't exist to convey meaning, but simply to project power. It's the extension of that into the sciences. And then the sciences don't exist in order to discover truth and communicate it. Instead, they exist simply to project power. So you go through the motions of science, but you already have your agenda in mind. So those are two very disturbing aspects of the movement. But I think there are some really promising things, too, and that is the fact that so many Christians are waking up to this, partly through the work of the Cornwall Alliance, and they're seeing that we can bring a completely different perspective to environmental issues that is a hopeful one instead of a despairing one, and that recognizes our capacity, using our God-given minds and our God-given hands, to actually improve the world and to improve human life.
Dr. Calvin Beisler is my guest today as we talk about where garden meets wilderness, evangelical entry into the environmental debate. Talking about the environmental debate, it does seem like there's a lot of emphasis on alarm and crisis that permeates the movement. And I guess that's probably, as you mentioned at the outset, if there are 13,000 groups and government funding and science, I mean, to keep funding going, we need to have alarms and crisis all the time,
yeah.
Don't we?
Yeah, that tends to be the case. I mean, right now, if you're in the sciences, if you can somehow or other link global warming into your research proposal and your funding request, the odds of your getting that funding go through the roof. If you're making a request for funding of some scientific research program that is not global warming related, your odds are pretty slim. And so you wind up with all kinds of amazing papers getting published in scientific journals that frankly have little to do with global warming but are tied to it just simply for the sake of gaining the funding. The United States government, for example, has spent over $79 billion on climate change-related research in about the last decade and a half. That's a whole lot of money, and that's only the U.S. government. European governments, every single one of them, have spent enormously on this. And the funny thing is that we haven't advanced in understanding at all what the U.N. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was predicting in the way of warming from CO2 released from our use of carbon fuels in energy. 25 years ago is essentially what it's predicting today, except that now it has it's less certain about that because it's now clear that the computer models that it used to make those predictions are grossly wrong. The average among those computer models overestimated how much warming you'd get from added CO2 by about 300%. In other words, estimated three times as much warming as has happened over the last 25 years, almost 30 years. And in fact, they also all failed to predict the fact that there has been no warming at all for at least the last 16 years, probably the last 17 to 18, maybe even the last 23 years. There's been no warming. So in fact, despite the spending of these billions and billions of dollars on the research, we know less now than we thought we knew 25 years ago.
So that's saying facts are stubborn things.
Yes. Yeah.
But it does seem like, at least in this area, in terms of climate change, that with the $79 billion invested over the last decade or so, that we're moving forward on a path regardless of the data, the statistics, right?
Yeah, it does. And I think that is because there was an agenda behind it in the first place. Much of the environmental movement, as I mentioned to you, really is committed to the notion that our governments need to be in control of every aspect of our lives. Environmentalism is really everythingism, stemming from the etymological root of the word, meaning everything. And so it wants to see government controlling more and more of our lives. Well, the best way to do that, the best way to justify that, is by saying our use of energy is causing some great, great catastrophe in the globe as a whole. And the reason for picking on energy there is that simply we use energy for everything we do. Whether it's producing food or clothing or shelter or transportation or education or healthcare or entertainment or communications or anything else, everything we do, we use energy. So if you can convince people that their use of energy is about to bring about a great catastrophe, threatening the survival of human civilization or maybe even of life on Earth, then they are willing to say, okay, I'll give up my freedom here. You go ahead and control it. That was a political agenda behind this in the first place, and it's one that is being pushed contrary to the scientific evidence. The actual observational scientific evidence says that our effect on global average temperature by the emission of carbon dioxide into the greenhouse gases is minuscule compared with natural influences, and certainly not dangerous.
You know, let's talk about the use of energy, because you talk a lot about sort of increased development of resources at the same time we're using more of them, and that, so you don't I don't get a sense that you're bothered by the using up of maybe finite resources.
Well, as an economist, I have to point out that the notion of the finitude of resources is technically true, but practically irrelevant. The reason for that is that as a resource becomes increasingly scarce, if it does, its price rises. And as that price rises, all sorts of adjustments get made. We decide to substitute other resources for it. We become more efficient in how we use it. We get much better at finding new sources for it and things like that. And so we will technically, from an economic perspective, we'll technically never run out of any given resource. Instead, long before we would run out of it, its price would rise so high that we would substitute other things. And historically, what we see is that every time we make one of those substitutions, we wind up using a resource that is more efficient for us, that yields greater benefit at lower cost. That's specifically been the case in terms of energy resources. We've gone from wood to peat to coal to oil to natural gas to nuclear. And as we do that, we are getting far more energy out of far less substance. Nuclear, for instance, has about 1,009 times as much power in a given gram of substance, right, as does wind or solar. And so as we make these changes, we actually get more of the resource, because the real resource is not the oil that you take out of the ground or the coal or the iron ore or something like that. The real resource is the service that you get from it. And every time we find it tougher to get that service from one thing, we switch to another thing and get it even better. And that's part of how God wove the warp and woof of this world, and part of what resulted from his having given us his image, his mind, his ability to think and to understand the world around us. So, no, I'm not worried about our running out of resources. And as I said earlier, the long-term historical price trend of every single extractive resource, whether it's mineral, animal, or vegetable, is downward. There's only one resource whose the price of which, the inflation-adjusted price of which, is upward instead of downward. And surprisingly enough, that's people. That is the cost of human labor over time has been rising, adjusted for inflation, which means that despite the fact that we've got more people, people are getting more scarce, not less scarce. Everything else is getting less scarce, not more scarce. And that's highly counterintuitive, but if you understand the fact that people make resources, they don't just consume them, then it all makes sense.
Wow. I'm going to take a minute to think about that, and I'll go out and adjust my wind turbine here for a while, and then we'll come back and talk more with Cal Beisner. From the Cornwall Alliance, we're talking about his book, Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate, and the video series called Resisting the Green Dragon, which you can find at resistingthegreendragon.com. More in a moment.
This is Wayne Peterson, president of HCJB Global, with Beyond the Call.
David was proud to be the richest man in his city in Romania. He had powerful friends in high places. But the business practices that helped him obtain that wealth also ended up landing him in prison. Soon all of his so-called friends disappeared. Well, it's in prison that David found Jesus. And through the experience, his life was totally changed. Today, David is determined to use the remaining years of his life to see people transformed through the message of the gospel. Through a legitimate business he runs, David provides funds for a Christian radio station in Romania so that all will be able to hear the gospel. God can turn a bad situation into a blessing. So trust him and then go beyond the call. This is Wayne Peterson. Always be willing and ready to go beyond the call. And then visit us online at hcjb.org.
Good word for us today. We're at 9 minutes before the hour and talking today with Dr. Cal Beisner, who's a founder and a national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance. You can find out more about the Cornwall Alliance at cornwallalliance.org. In fact, they have a weekly email newsletter, which I recommend. It's a great way to kind of keep up with what's going on in the world of environmental concerns. Ryan and I were just talking during the break a little bit about how environmental influence is so strong in the schools. Some of your thoughts on, Cal, ways that we can maybe counteract that? I mean, our kids, drive the agenda many times.
Yeah, or rather, our kids are driven by an agenda, frankly. The first thing that I would say is simply that Christian parents have to accept the responsibility given to us in Deuteronomy chapter 6, that it is our duty to shape our children's minds, to make sure that they know the Word of God, that we teach it to them, that we impart to them a solid biblical worldview. Now, some parents may say, well, gee, I don't know how to do that. Well, then maybe you need to get into your Christian bookstore and get away from the trinkets and go to the really solid books on Christian worldview and buy those and read them. Things like, for instance, Nancy Piercy's book, Total Truth, or Herb Schlossberg's book, Idols for Destruction, things like this. But Christian parents have got to take first responsibility, and I'll go a little farther here and probably step on some toes. We need to have our children out of Pharaoh's Academy and into Christ's Academy. That is, whether we homeschool them or we have them in a private Christian school, one way or the other, we need to make sure that their education is solidly Christian. Now, I know that over 90% of Christian parents' children are going to our public schools, and that is a problem because our public schools are dominated by an anti-Christian worldview. To some extent, that still is the secular atheistic worldview that has dominated for about the last 50 or 60 years, but increasingly it's becoming an Eastern mystical pantheistic worldview. And if your children are in the public schools, you need, as a Christian parent, to be keeping solid, careful, constant watch on what they are being taught, and you need to counter and refute those parts that are anti-Christian. I know that that Focus on the Family and Family Research Council and others produce a lot of helpful material that can help you with that. Certainly on environmental issues, I would urge you to come to cornwallalliance.org, read some of the papers and articles that we have there, and get Resisting the Green Dragon. This is a 12-lecture video series plus a half-hour documentary film. And it even has a printable leader's discussion guide with it. Essentially what that means is that it's a quarter curriculum, curriculum for a full Sunday school quarter or homeschool or private Christian school quarter on a biblical Christian approach to environmental stewardship. That's something that could be very helpful to many parents. There's also, by the way, a book that is not duplicative. It's actually completely independently produced, but it is titled Resisting the Green Dragon, Dominion.Death. by the Christian physicist Dr. James Wunless that we also publish and is available at resistingthegreendragon.com.
Good. Cal, before we go, just talk a little bit about maybe what are the real issues at stake for our nation or our world or maybe as individuals as we see the environmental movement so strong and growing.
Well, most importantly, it's a question of whether we're going to pursue a world that lives to the glory of God or a world that lives to not the glory, but really the destruction of human beings. You know, Satan hates God. He cannot attack God directly, obviously. So instead, he attacks God's image bearer. He attacks mankind. And there is, in fact, a way that we can see all the major different culture battles that we fight in the culture war. They're all tied together. We have a pamphlet that we produce at Cornwall Alliance called Putting Together the Pieces in the Spiritual World War that shows how the sexual liberation movement, the homosexual movement, the population control movement, the pro-abortion movement, socialism, communism, all of these things tie together because of their attack on Genesis 1, 27 and 28. 27 tells us the essence of man, image of God, male and female. 28 tells us the mission of man to fill and subdue the earth. And Satan doesn't like any of that, and so he tries to tear it all down. As we put our world together, worldview together comprehensively and biblically, we can see how these different parts of the battle are tied together, and then we can fight them more strategically and more effectively. So, you know, that's kind of where I would point people. Again, come to cornwallalliance.org or just go online and Google for Putting Together the Pieces in the Spiritual World War, and you'll find that particular article is available online as well as a printed pamphlet.
Dr. Calvin Beisner is our guest today, founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. You can find out more about their great resources online, cornwallalliance.org. We also mentioned the 12-week video series, Resisting the Green Dragon. Check that out at resistingthegreendragon.com. Cal, always good to visit with you. Thanks for some important insight and teaching today, and we enjoy our opportunity to visit. Hope to have you back again soon.
Well, thank you, Neil. God bless, and God bless you, Ryan, and someday I'd love to visit you in eastern Montana.
There you go. I knew you were a good guy, so
yeah.
I knew it.
Cal Beisner joining us today here on Connecting Faith. By the way, you can always catch the podcast. You missed part of it, and something you want to pass on to a friend, or maybe just reflect on some more if you have some discussions about various things as the headlines pop up regarding what's going on in the environmental movement, at least. You can go to our website, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. By the way, when you're there on the website, myfaithradio.com, don't forget about our pastor appreciation opportunity for you to sign up your pastor and spouse for an opportunity to relax a free week away at a retreat center in Colorado. And it's expenses paid. It's a great opportunity to bless your pastor during a pastor appreciation month. So check that out, myfaithradio.com. And then send us a comment or two about why you want your pastor nominated. And we'll read some of those on the air as well. Thanks for listening to Connecting Faith.